afternoon. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, almost our culture, current events, our Catholic faith, 50 minutes of the afternoon. This afternoon, looking at Time Magazine's Man of the Year, of course, that's Donald Trump, and interesting insight into how they made the selection and what they did within the selection, and we're going to hear some audio from the Time Magazine people themselves talking about this process and what it was all about, and maybe even asking the question or answering the question, is it really a compliment? I don't know. Also, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. I want to talk about what this means to us personally, how we can live this out, how we can see this as a beautiful realization of what it means to follow the will of God. That in relation to a meme on my Facebook page, which really has nothing to do with the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. I just thought it was cool. I saw it on Mark Shea's page. Fell in love with it, immediately posted it on my Facebook page, so feel free to share that. And then in our final segment, looking at some of Trump's cabinet picks, I think we've had questions and maybe some head-scratching going on because of some of the positions so far. Now, the new labor secretary getting named, we'll talk about who that is and why this is of interest and what it could mean for the job market, the prospects of increased minimum wage, all of the things that have been batted around here for some time. All of that and more. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Back in just a minute.
If you enjoy listening to the Leo Brown Almost Hour, consider becoming a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
Good afternoon, I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Our Culture, current events, our Catholic faith, 50 minutes every afternoon. Time Magazine, Man of the Year, Donald Trump. Not necessarily a compliment, according to Time Magazine. They simply say they choose these individuals based on the impact that they've had from a newsworthy standpoint and kind of what they've done to impact the culture, and that's how they become the Man of the Year. And I think they say this cautiously because of their readership. They know that they would alienate half, either way you slice it, if they're saying, well, we embrace Trump and all he stands for. So I think they're cognizant of that. But also positioning him on the cover of Time Magazine with President of the Divided States of America. So I think that says a lot as well. But some interesting insight from Time Magazine on how they made this choice and what goes into it. And let's take a listen to this, and then we'll talk about it on the other side.
Every year we choose the person of the year who is the individual who has had the most influence on events, for better or worse. It's hard to argue that anyone had more influence than Donald Trump over the events of this year.
You know, I didn't get Beyonce and Jay-Z and Bruce Springsteen to get crowds. I had just me and ideas that people wanted to hear.
But there's a profound argument about whether his influence was for the better or for the worse. And that really is the challenge that faces him. The country came through this election season more divided, conspicuously, publicly, than at any time through any election cycle that most of us can remember.
I think we're going to have a lot of jobs brought back. I think we're going to have a lot fewer companies leaving our country. I believe we will be successful with defeating ISIS or bringing them down to a level where it's almost the same thing. And I hope I'm judged from the time of the election as opposed to from January 20th, because the stock market has had a tremendous bounce and people are seeing very good things for business in this country.
One of the things that was remarkable in going to see him, to interview him, is to be in that penthouse, which is the most ostentatious imaginable marble and mirrors and gold, and see him in the suit and the diamond cufflinks. There's a kind of dissonance that we pressed him about, of how is it that the billionaire is the tribune of the working man? He said he thought that it had to do with that he wasn't a phony, that there have certainly been wealthy politicians before who in some cases would bend over backwards to make themselves appear like the common man or do anything that they could, eating the corn dog at the Iowa State Fair and wearing a flannel shirt in New Hampshire. I think he had a very strong instinct that his wealth and the flamboyant display of his wealth was not a liability, that it was actually an asset. Donald Trump is very comfortable sitting down and answering questions, although he very frequently does not remotely answer the question that you asked. In one sense, it feels very undisciplined. In another sense, maybe it's very disciplined in that he knows what he will and will not talk about and is unabashed in completely changing the subject.
Do you feel changed by your election? And how do you think, you know, if I play this tape back in 4 or 8 years, the office will have changed you?
Well, it's a very humbling experience, I can tell you, as somebody that loves this country. It's a very large country, but it's also a even more powerful country than the numbers, because if you look at China and India, and you have others with more people, but when you look at what we do in this country, it's the most incredible place on earth.
A lot of people think that Person of the Year, just because the nature of the name, is an honor. And certainly there have been years where we have recognized people whose influence has been altogether unassailably worthy. Normally that's not the case. I know there are a lot of people who disagree with so much of what Donald Trump said and are very apprehensive about what his presidency means for them and for the country. I think I would challenge them to suggest that someone else this year had more influence and in a way a greater surprise than what he did in 2016.
Interesting, I think perhaps telling what we hear there when it comes to maybe some of the what appears to be a somewhat haphazard that perhaps is very calculated in Donald Trump. And, you know, you could look at that and say, is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Shrewd as serpents, gentle as doves is what Scripture calls us to be as people of faith. And are we seeing some of that reflected in Donald Trump's attitudes? Are we seeing some of that shrewdness, perhaps, but are we seeing the gentleness as the dove? So it's really an interesting dynamic when we consider who we have about to step into the presidency and what that really ultimately means. The country is divided, but I posted a post from America Magazine with a Jesuit writing on this upcoming decision by the Electoral College, either to stick with the decision of the electorate or to counter that decision based on their votes. And certainly there are those such as this particular author who is concerned about a Trump presidency and really praying for a turn that would result in an overturning of the electoral decision, which, of course, would go in favor of the popular vote. That, to me, is not a solution. If we're wanting this country to heal, reversing a decision that is already galvanized many, regardless of whether you like the guy or not, I don't think is a healing way of approaching this. I think what we have to do is work within the circumstances that we have. I think we have to find a way to make this work given what we have. Now, that is always a little bit more difficult, because if we could wave a magic wand and say, okay, everything is going to be fixed and we'll be back where we were, generally, well, I'm not going to say generally, I'm going to say it invariably. How about that? I don't think that this ever is not the case. You could do something of that nature without collateral damage. Now, you could say, well, I've got a magic wand, so I could fix that too. Well, you don't. The Electoral College coming out with reversing a decision that has been established to this degree, I believe, would be detrimental. You think we got a divided country now? We haven't seen anything yet if that were to happen. The anger, the rancor, the outcry, the protests, we haven't seen anything. Because I think at least at this point, now those who favored a Hillary Clinton presidency have at least begun to grasp some sort of acceptance. And undoubtedly, those who have embraced the favor of this election as it is have galvanized their celebration. If we go and we mess with that now, I think that we're not on our road to heal. We're on a road to even deeper division, deeper scarring, and greater challenge. So the only thing that I think can be done is ride this course while at the same time looking for opportunities to address the issues that are presented if and when they come, which, again, I would say invariably there's going to be something, right? This is not utopia. We did not step in after this election into a new world of existence where nothing goes wrong. Yes, things will go wrong. Even in the best of cases, we're still human, we're fallen, and things will go wrong. So what we have to do is anticipate that and be prepared to address whatever those issues are. We talked about this earlier in the week, this priest, prophet, king concept. That's how we have to, we're called to be that. This is what the very nature of our faith demands of us. And at any given point, we have to assume that role. They're not necessarily Trinitarian in nature that they all kind of coincide. They have very specific roles for specific times. Now, I think many of us have tried to hear the voice of God. We've tried to speak prophetically. We've tried to say, maybe something needs to look a little different here. Maybe we're not seeing the big picture. We've done that through this election cycle, and here we are. So what could happen, and it still is a wait and see, is we could continue to speak prophetically. We could continue to try to dismantle conventional wisdom. We could see where that leads us. Or perhaps our prophecy has already been established and prophets bring a shattering of the conventional wisdom. If that plays out to the point that now we're left picking up the pieces, then guess what? We have to assume the role of king. We have to assume that, not our leadership. Those of us who are willing to step into an understanding of being another Christ in the world. Now we have to be that king. We have to be that one who is willing to reassemble, re-nurture, replant, and rule with benevolence that says, you know what, there's plenty of room in this kingdom. Because you know what? It's like the mustard seed. It may have started small, but it's big, and it only gets bigger, and there's all kinds of amazing room in here. That may be where we're called. We'll see. Time will tell. More to come. We'll talk about the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, which is today. More to come in just a moment. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown Almost Hour. Back after this.
If you enjoy listening to the Leo Brown Almost Hour, consider becoming a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown Almost Hour. Culture, current events, our Catholic faith, 50 minutes every afternoon. Today, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, often confused feast, even among Catholics, because we assume Immaculate Conception means it's the conception of Jesus, which it is not. It's the conception of Mary, preserved from all eternity, as we call it, of original sin. And it's, I think, a difficult dynamic to wrap our heads around as people of faith. Unfortunately, we just don't necessarily understand why that's important, for one, or even what it is. We kind of play along, I think, as Catholics, and some go to Holy Day Masses, and we kind of get that it's a big deal, but I don't know that we really know why. I posted a meme that I found, which in essence has nothing to do with the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. It has more to do with the Feast of the Nativity than anything, but I just really, really like it. And it shows an immigrant couple, we can assume in this depiction, being of Latin origin, and on the payphone trying to find a place to stay with all of this imagery all around. It's beautiful. I just love it. This is the image I want to see of the Holy Family. An image that is completely inserted into today's dynamic. Because that's what we were dealing with. That is exactly what we were dealing with in the first century. We had an immigrant couple in a foreign land without a place to stay, with a pregnant woman ready to give birth at any time, with no one willing to offer space for them because all the places were taken. The census had been called and it was packed up. But there was one place remaining, the place where animals were kept, the manger. And you think about, and this is one of the reasons why, it's not the only reason, not even the primary reason, but it is one of the reasons why Mary was preserved from original sin, because we all have a concupiscence, we have a propensity towards sin. Even when we're in our best case of scrubbed upness, walking straight out of the confessional or having just been baptized, we're gonna have gravity pulling at us because we always have that propensity. And generally what that would look like, especially in a case of this nature, is some degree of doubt. Some degree, at the very least, in the best case situation, moving through this dynamic as Joseph and Mary was, they're at least going to doubt. The very least, Mary's going to doubt. So I have to wonder about this dynamic that we see portrayed in this meme, but also in this narrative. We don't necessarily hear this, right? We don't hear this. We get the story told to us. It may have been second to third hand. It could have been Mary telling the story, which would explain why we don't hear this, because her amazing humility, I think, would prevent this from even being part of her recounting the story. But think about this. I think that she had to be encouraging. She had to be there saying to Joseph, you know what, it's okay. This is going to work out. I promise you, it may look bad, but we're going to get through this. And isn't that interesting? Because I think generally we think about, in the male-female dynamic, the one who is going to be the encourager, generally, is the man. Or at least the one who's going to be at the helm of the journey. Everything's fine. We'll get there. Don't worry. This is typically a role that modern man has assumed. But what if that dynamic was completely different in this situation? And granted, Joseph running on faith, obviously. He had the dream. The angel spoke to him. He knew what was going on. He knew that it was his call to do this. But how much encouragement may have been coming from our Blessed Mother? Because she knew. She knew the end of the story from the beginning. Because it wasn't a dream that she had. It was a true annunciation. It was an angel saying to her, this is going to happen. We want this to happen. We want this to happen. And you've been chosen. And the confidence that could come from that, and the amazing assuredness, even with every odd stacked against them, and especially because of her sinless nature. She's not going to despair. She's not going to panic. Not going to fall prey to anxiety or negativity or fatalistic thinking.
this is all going to work out. It's going to work out. Joseph will find it. It's just around the corner. You know, I think so often in our faith walk, we have that kind of challenge ourselves that we wonder. We wonder if it's going to work out. We doubt. We have tremendous fears. We're weak. We don't do this well. We don't reassure one another. And I think especially in the dynamic of marriage, think about how beautiful that could be, because if we're mutually reassuring, not just mutually receptive to one another, but mutually supportive and really legitimately supportive, not just, hey, don't worry, your pretty little head, whatever, not dismissive, but truly supportive in a sense of, you know what, that we got the goods. We got the goods. We're going to make this work. We're going to make this work beyond every possible odd imaginable. To have that kind of confidence. And you think about the sacramentality of marriage. You think about this marriage bond that is supposed to bring with it. Certainly in the most ideal situations, a degree of mirroring of this God and man mentality dynamic, this understanding that there is something new, there is something bonded, there is something greater than the sum, there is something that is so much more present. That truly sacramental reality could be a history-changing experience, as it was from Mary and Joseph. You think about that. So while we can't be preserved from original sin, we don't have that luxury, but we do have the luxury of the sacrament of reconciliation. And for those of us in the married sacramental reality, we have that. So what if we could tap into that? What if we could really tap into that grace that says, you know what, you're bigger than this. You know what, you're going to not only survive, but you're going to thrive because we've got the goods. We've been promised the goods. It's like that Steve Harvey video that's out there where he does the Family Feud, and then apparently it comes out afterwards and he does this little kind of wrap up sort of thank you for coming and here's a little bit of inspiration. Interestingly enough, he was talking about jumping out with trust, right? Jumping out that with the trust that grace is going to be there, that God is going to open your parachute or give you the parachute, or you've got the parachute. Now, I think so often we forget just how much God does have our backs when it comes to trusting. And especially, and we talk about this little child type of attitude that Jesus talks about. Well, what I'm reminded of is every time my four-year-old wants me to catch him, wherever he's jumping from, it doesn't matter how high, it doesn't matter how far, he will jump from the top of the stairs to the bottom without reservation because he knows I've never dropped him. He will fall backwards from the kitchen chair into my arms without reservation because he knows I'm there. If only we were to do the same. While we can't be immaculately conceived, we could have an immaculate faith. We could. We could be so confident and so assured and so without reservation about everything that God has promised that even though we don't see it now, we know what's coming. Even though it might be dim, maybe far off, the kingdom is now. It's here. Jesus promises us that if we're just willing to have the eyes of faith to see it. That which is the small mustard seed, that which is that tiny, tiny little seed, grows into an amazing, flourishing, bountiful, fruitful experience. So as I look at this day of the Feast of the Immaculate Conception and realize it's about unreservedness. I posted a post from Pope Francis talking about this exact thing. It's that abandonment, total abandonment to self, total abandonment to logic, to reason, to emotion, to fear, abandon it all. Let that fill your parachute. Let that wind fill your sails. Watch what happens. Watch what providence really looks like, because I assure you, you will discover providence. More to come in a moment on Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Back after this.
You're listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour, Culture, Current Events, Our Catholic Faith, 50 minutes every afternoon. Well, we keep seeing the cabinet positions stack up, and there's obvious direction that Donald Trump is taking, which I don't think is surprising by any means when we kind of know this is what he's all about. We're seeing business people, we're seeing not politician types taking these roles. I think one of the more interesting stories is the CEO of Carl's Jr. and Hardee's, who is coming in to be labor secretary, and Andrew Puzder. I don't know how to say his name. I have not heard it pronounced. I have only read it. But this is a guy apparently who turned around the fast food chain. And it's hard to say what the big three. I don't know what the big three are right now, right? There's McDonald's number one still. Burger King, is it Hardee's or is it Wendy's that kind of fills in that third slot? Really not sure, but definitely one of the leading chains of fast food that is out there. It's in the upper echelon. So you could look at this, I think, in a couple of ways. You could, one, say, well, this guy has obviously managed labor well enough to really have a turnaround in the company, to have the opportunity for this to succeed. But then the other is, well, this guy's doing fast food, which fast food is a assembly line of production for the lowest common denominator of skill and pay in any industry. It simply is. Now, again, its brilliance is its fault to some degree, because what you don't have, and I guess it depends on how you look at it, there could be. And obviously there are bigger jobs, there are places where people can go, there has to be some degree of advancement. But then at some point, you can only go so far, and you're undoubtedly going to start at some beginning rung. And that beginning rung is going to look like probably a part-time with the absolute lowest possible pay imaginable. Now, I've got a completely different ethic on this, because running a startup, I know how challenging the financial side of this can be. And there's a completely different dynamic in early days of everybody kind of scrapping together and saying, we're going to do this, because I can assure you, early startups, not everybody gets paid, right? Those who do are very privileged, because many are putting in their investment time in a startup to get it off the ground, to make it work. And generally, the last person to see anything at all is the guy in charge. But if you've been down this road like this gentleman has, Puzder, I don't know, from 1997 when he stepped in to take over, my guess is you probably made a dollar or two. And if you haven't then found a way to say, okay, we're going to use this opportunity to reward our employees or to give them job security or to have them be able to work a living wage so they can actually do this and feed their family, then I think we got to look at justice. We got to ask ourselves, is this just? Because I think this is one of the bigger questions that we've seen recently is it really just to pay what the minimum wage is when it comes to knowing that there are plenty of people who would have to work for that amount and never be able to have any degree of advancement. And again, a completely different dynamic from those who are scraping by investing in something larger because they're all on the ground floor and an established company that just makes it the policy to do it this way. So you could look at this a couple of ways. I think the Trump fan, the Trumpologist, as I call them, those who see Trump as doing no wrong, which, as an aside, generally those who are Trumpologists aren't the best at being apologists for Pope Francis, I've discovered. But that's another thing. Maybe we'll have time to get into it in a moment. But so the Trumpologist is going to look at this and say, well, that's good business. Good business is good government. Because if we're doing this effectively, what we have done is now we've established a clear precedent that says we got to figure it out. We can do this. We can do it efficiently. We can make this work just like business. And Justice Trump himself says, well, it's smart business not to pay income tax or whatever it was, whatever his taxes were, his tax liability. You've got to, you can see this in two different, completely different dynamics. Is it really smart business? Perhaps. But is it just? Because there's something about government that simply can't just be business. And I'm a capitalist. So please understand, I'm not a socialist. I'm not a communist. I don't believe in redistribution of wealth. I don't believe in this crazy levelized playing field. I think everybody needs the opportunity to have a place to advance and to grow. But I also believe that everyone should be rewarded for what they do. And especially for those who step in on the bottom rung, there needs to be a place for them to go from there. We need to find ways for them to advance or to build platforms around them for them to grow on their own. This is the Dave Ramsey Entree leadership model, right? Watch read anything that he's written on this. Or you can watch it, I'm sure. You YouTube it, you can find Entree Leadership seminars. But it's all about giving people the opportunity to grow within your organization and allowing them to be somewhat unfettered in that, to really give them decision-making opportunities and development opportunities to grow their ideas into something that can be bigger even than they ever imagined. I don't know that fast food does that. Maybe it does. Maybe it does at Carl's Jr. and Hardee's. I know this. I worked at Hardee's. I worked at three different Hardee's, believe it or not. So from the time I was in high school, when I started in the first Hardee's, to going to college and then coming back to my home for a summer, I managed to move three times at different Hardee's. And I will say this. I will, with every degree of sincerity, say that I appreciated the fact that they let me transfer because I did raise above minimum wage very quickly. There was that opportunity to always, it was merit pay. It was based on my performance and how well I did. And I worked my butt off then, just as I do now. I've always had a solid work ethic. You can't grow up working on farms. I didn't grow up on a farm, but I grew up working in tobacco. And you can't do that and not have a work ethic. So that, you know, I got in there and busted, worked hard and managed to get a significant amount of pay above minimum wage. It was, minimum wage was $3.35. I think I may have been making closer to $4 an hour by the time I stopped. But you think about that, right? That was 30 some odd years ago. But the company was gracious enough to realize that I needed to move because, first off, I'm in high school, I'm going to college. Oh, that job is waiting for you in your college town. At the same pay rate that you had when you left there before. Oh, and you need to go home. Okay, well, you know what? There's not a position at that one, but there's another one just 10 miles away. You can go there and work, and you can keep your pay rate. So for me, my personal experience was very positive with Hardee's. I thought they did a terrific job allowing me to do that. And I remember thinking then, they didn't have to do this. They could have easily just said, sorry about your luck, you have to start back at the bottom rung, but they didn't. So I was very pleased to have that experience. And even finally got to the point where there was shift priority and all of this. I mean, it was a couple of years of time where I went from these three Hardee's, but it was always very positive, and I enjoyed it tremendously. I thought, well, it's a good place to work. Now, when I discovered that I could wait tables, actually, but the transition was going to deliver pizzas before waiting tables, but then when I started working for tips, and I realized, oh my goodness, that minimum wage stuff is crazy. So first in pizza delivery, then in table waiting, that changed the dynamic entirely as far as what I knew I could do. And it made it much, much more lucrative than fast food. But again, we got to look at this and we got to wonder, I don't know, it could be good for labor. We got an experienced guy who's had to make some very obviously difficult decisions. If you've been at something that long, the decisions are not easy. But you make the decisions and you make it for the best, ideally for the best of everyone, and you look for successes. So, yeah, it's already being roundly criticized, Huffington Post, with what they're saying. I'm going to post this over on my Facebook page so you can take a look at that. But this is where we are at this point. We really know nothing. We know who Trump is assembling. We're watching these things come together. It's making many people nervous. It's making many people happy. Same would be true if it was Hillary Clinton. There would be those who are getting nervous now. There would be those who are getting ecstatic now. It's just how it works in politics. And unfortunately, as long as we stay partisan before we are a community, we're always going to have that division. So again, as I said, as we began the show, time will tell as we move through this, what our role of people of faith really needs to be. Is it being a cheerleader? Is it being a mentor? Is it being one who can see the challenges and we're willing to maybe call it out, or we're willing to address this in some fashion? What do we need to do? How do we need to be in this dynamic? I think those are questions that we'll only answer as we move through. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. God bless.
If you enjoy listening to the Leo Brown Almost Hour, consider becoming a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.